the end result being that this would eventually bankrupt the country. In its various modern incarnations, this argument also sounds quite familiar. These ideas inevitably set off a great debate that resonated throughout the next two centuries, and in a broader context, has continued unabated up to the present time. In some ways, it is quite surprising that the debate has not been put to rest, because Malthus's ideas were heavily criticized and summarily dismissed, almost from the moment he proposed them, by many of the most influential social and economic thinkers across the entire political spectrum. And for good reasons, as we shall see. Over the last 200 years, widespread criticism has come, and continues to come, from diverse quarters ranging from Marxists and socialists to libertarian free market enthusiasts, and from social conservatives and feminists to human rights advocates. A classic criticism that I find particularly amusing was that of Marx and Engels, who dismissed Malthus as a lackey of the bourgeoisie, sounding like a parody of themselves from a Monty Python skit. On the other hand, Malthus's ideas have influenced many important thinkers, even if some didn't entirely agree with everything he said. These have included the great economist John Maynard Keynes, as well as Alfred Russel Wallace and Charles Darwin, the originators of the theory of natural selection. In more recent years, with the burgeoning concerns over global sustainability, Malthus's ideas have been broadened to include questions of resource limitation in general, not just food, with less emphasis on the poor and even on population growth, but rather on general questions of the environment, climate change, and the recognition that these issues transcend geography and economic class. However, among mainstream economists and social thinkers, Malthusian theory, with its implications of imminent catastrophe, has become a dirty word. Most believe that the basic assumptions of the theory are fundamentally wrong, and there is plenty of evidence to back them up. Perhaps of greatest importance is that, in complete contradiction to Malthus's expectations, agricultural productivity did not increase linearly with time, but instead tracked population growth and increased exponentially. Furthermore, there has been a steady decrease in human fecundity, accompanied by a steady increase in the average standard of living. As average wages increase and access to contraception becomes more accessible, workers insist on reproducing less rather than more. I have met scant few economists who do not automatically dismiss traditional Malthusian-like ideas of eventual or imminent collapse as naive, simplistic, or just plain wrong. On the other hand, I have met scant few physicists or ecologists who think it's nuts to believe otherwise. The late maverick economist Kenneth Boulding perhaps best summed it up when testifying before the U.S. Congress, declaring that anyone who believes exponential growth can go on forever in a finite world is either a madman or an economist. Most economists, social scientists, politicians, and business leaders typically justify their optimistic views by appealing to the canonical mantra of innovation as the magic wand that will keep us exponentially afloat. They rightly point out that it has been our extraordinary inventiveness and openness to change and innovation, driven in large part by a free market economy that has continued to fuel exponential growth and increase standards of living. The original argument of Malthus was wrong because of the unforeseen technological advances in agriculture stimulated by the spirit and discoveries of the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution. These led to inventions such as the thresher, the binder, the cotton gin, the steam tractor, and the wrought iron plough with steel cutting edges, as well as advances in crop rotation and the increasing use of commercially produced fertilizer. These contributed enormously to the greater efficiency of production by increasing yields and mechanizing processes that for the previous 10,000 years had primarily been done by hand. In 1830, it took almost 300 hours of human labor to grow 100 bushels of wheat. By 1890, this was reduced to less than 50 hours. Today, it takes less than a few hours. Our own time has seen an extraordinary continuation of this amazing revolution in food productivity, as agriculture has become increasingly industrialized. Food production in the developed world is dominated by huge agribusiness consortia who use science and technology to maximize yields and optimize distribution. This mechanization of food production, in which meat, fish, and vegetables are effectively manufactured in production lines in huge factories, as if they were cars or television sets, has been rapidly spreading across the globe, providing sustenance for billions of people at affordable prices. Just to get a sense of the scale of the change, consider, for example, that in 1967 there were roughly 1 million pig farms in the United States, whereas today there are only about 100,000, and over 80% of the pigs presently being produced are from these dedicated factory farms. Four companies alone now produce 81% of the cattle, 73% of the sheep, 57% of the pigs, and 50% of the chickens consumed in the United States. Globally, 74% of the world's poultry, 43% of its beef, and 68% of its eggs are produced this way. Consequently, not much more than 1% of the U.S. population now works in agriculture, compared with about a quarter of the population in the 1930s, when, on average, each farm worker supplied food to about 11 consumers. Today, that number is closer to 100. This tremendous gain in efficiency and the huge decrease in the need for agricultural labor has been a major driver behind the exponential growth in the population of cities. It's hard not to be convinced by the innovation argument when thinking about long-term sustainability. Just think of the amazing array of new gadgets, machines, artifacts, processes, and ideas that have been generated over the past 200 years, let alone the last 20. From airplanes, automobiles, computers, and the internet, to the theory of relativity, quantum mechanics, and natural selection, it has been an unimaginable exponential joyride. A planet on steroids with an endless supply of more wonders than Alibaba or Horatio could ever have dreamed of. According to the World Bank, one of the major Millennium Development Goals set by the United Nations in 2000, namely to cut the 1990 poverty rate in half by 2015, was attained 5 years ahead of schedule in 2010. Furthermore, on average, people today are living longer and at a higher standard of living than ever before. That's one side of the coin. The other is that half of the world's population is still living on less than $2.50 a day, with up to 1 billion people lacking adequate access to clean drinking water or enough food to eat. It seems that despite all of our marvelous advances, the Malthusian threat is still lurking in the background. This was forcefully argued almost 50 years ago in the best-selling popular book, The Population Bomb, published in 1968 by the ecologist Paul Ehrlich. It began by throwing down the gauntlet and provocatively proclaiming that the battle to feed all of humanity is over. In the 1970s, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now. At this late date, nothing can prevent a substantial increase in the world death rate. Similar dire predictions, such as, I don't see how India could possibly feed 200 million more people by 1980, were made, and a series of draconian suggestions, including forced sterilization, were proposed for mitigating the impending catastrophe. Shortly thereafter, in 1972, a study carried out by Dennis Meadows and Jay Forrester at MIT, titled The Limits to Growth, was published. It focused on exploring how finite resources will affect a continuation of exponential growth, and what the potential consequences of business as usual might be. The research was sponsored by an organization called the Club of Rome, a confederation of distinguished world citizens sharing a common concern for the future of humanity, and including former heads of state, diplomats, scientists, economists, and business leaders from around the globe. The study was the first serious attempt to model possible scenarios for the sustainability of the planet using available data combined with computer simulations on food production, population growth, industrialization, non-renewable resources, and pollution. As such, it is the forerunner of subsequent attempts to seriously model the planet's future, including the recent modeling of climate change. Like Malthus's essay and Ehrlich's book, The Limits to Growth received a lot of attention in the popular media and was equally provocative in stimulating debates about the future of the planet. And like those, it received considerable criticism, especially from economists, for its failure to include the dynamics of innovation. A leading critic was the well-known economist Julian Simon, who expressed a fairly extreme vision of the view held by many economists that the spectacular growth we have witnessed over the past 200 years will be sustained forever by human ingenuity and our continued ability to innovate. In fact, Simon argued in his 1981 book, The Ultimate Resource, that a larger population is actually better because it stimulates even more technological innovation, inventiveness, and ingenuity, thereby leading to new ways of exploiting resources and increasing standards of living. As we move into the 21st century, this vision of a cornucopian horn of plenty, with its image of limitless barrels of fish being continuously replenished by the magic, not of divine intervention, but of the free expression of human ingenuity and the boundless possibilities of a free market economy, has re-emerged as a significant component of corporate and political conceptual thinking. Indeed, Simon's views have effectively been embraced by many in the academic, business, and political communities. A succinct summary of this view was articulately expressed by the economist Paul Romer, one of the founders of endogenous growth theory, which holds that economic growth is driven primarily by investment in human capital, innovation, and knowledge creation. Romer declares that every generation has perceived the limits to growth that finite resources and undesirable side effects would pose if no new recipes or ideas were discovered. And every generation has underestimated the potential for finding new recipes and ideas. We consistently fail to grasp how many ideas remain to be discovered. Possibilities do not add up. They multiply. Put slightly differently, this proclaims that ideas and innovation increase multiplicatively, that is, exponentially, and not arithmetically, that is, linearly, in tandem with the exponential growth in population, and that the process is open-ended and effectively limitless. On the other hand, the last few decades have also seen a resurfacing of the spiritual successors of the population bomb and the limits to growth, with the rise of the environmental movement and the development of a serious concern for the future of the planet. Closely related to this is a deep concern for the impact of unregulated corporate and political ambition, which has stimulated a perceived need for corporate social responsibility. Bridging the divide and reducing the continuous tension between rampant capitalism, packaged as the engine of innovation and ingenuity that fuels growth and prosperity for all, versus the doom and gloom concerns of environmentalists, and those who heed the warning signals of climate change and potential economic collapse, has emerged as one of the major political challenges of the 21st century. While it may not be unreasonable to hold the view that collective human ingenuity and innovation facilitated by a free market economy is the secret for maintaining long-term open-ended growth in defiance of potential collapse, I find it somewhat baffling that this is often coupled with a denial, or, at the very least, a deep skepticism concerning some of its inevitable consequences. Like many who advocate innovation as the panacea for meeting future global socio-economic challenges, Simon was a vocal skeptic when it came to believing that human activity caused global environmental damage or was the origin of serious health concerns, whether from climate change, pollution, or chemical contamination. The spirit and substance of the second law of thermodynamics and its manifestation in terms of entropy production represent the dark side of open-ended exponential growth. Independent of how superbly innovative we are, ultimately everything is driven and processed by the use of energy, and the processing of energy has inevitable, deleterious consequences. 6. It's all energy, stupid. Globally, we use an enormous amount of energy, somewhere in the range of about 150 trillion kilowatt hours a year. This is one of those astronomical numbers, like the annual budget of the United States, whose magnitude and meaning are extremely difficult for most of us mere mortals to comprehend, making our eyes glaze over when we hear it. Commenting on the U.S. budget, the leader of the Senate Republicans from 1959 to 1969, Senator Everett Dirksen, was reputed to have said, "A billion here, a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money." And this at a time when the budget was 30 times smaller than its present size of around $3.5 trillion. This represents about $10,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States, which gives us a much better sense of its size. To get a similar sense of what the scale of the global energy consumption means, and to put its enormous magnitude into some sort of approachable perspective, here are a couple of comparisons that might help. I pointed out in the opening chapter that the 2,000 food calories a day you need to stay alive is equivalent to almost 100 watts, the power of a light bulb. You are extraordinarily efficient in your use of energy relative to anything that is man-made. Your dishwasher, for example, requires more than 10 times more energy per second than you do just to wash dishes, while your car uses it at a rate in excess of 1,000 times more just to move you around. When you add up all the energy an average human being on the planet uses to fuel all of the machinery, artifacts and infrastructure integral to modern life, it comes to about 30 times the rate of our natural energy requirements. To put it slightly differently, the rate at which we need to process energy to sustain our standard of living remained at just a few hundred watts for hundreds of thousands of years, until about 10,000 years ago when we began to form collective urban communities. This marked the beginning of the Anthropocene, in which our effective metabolic rate began its steady rise to its present level of more than 3,000 watts today. But this is just its average value taken across the entire planet. The rate at which energy is used in developed countries is far higher. In the United States, it is almost a factor of 4 larger, at a whopping 11,000 watts, which is more than 100 times larger than its natural biological value. This amount of power is not a lot smaller than the metabolic rate of a blue whale, which is more than 1,000 times larger in mass than we are. Thinking of us as an animal using 30 times more energy than we should, given our physical size, the effective human population of the planet accordingly operates as if it were much larger than the 7.3 billion people who actually inhabit it. In a very real sense, we are operating as if our population were at least 30 times larger, equivalent to a global population in excess of 200 billion people. If the most optimistic of cornucopian thinkers are correct, and the world's population reaches 10 billion by the end of the century, all living at a standard comparable to that of the United States, the subsequent effective population would then exceed 1 trillion people. This exercise not only gives a sense of scale for how much energy we use, but also illustrates just how far out of ecological equilibrium we have come relative to the rest of the natural world. Of equal significance is that this huge increase of energy consumption has taken place over an infinitesimally short period of time, when measured by evolutionary standards, so any systemic adjustment or adaptation to its impact has been almost impossible to accommodate. It has been estimated, for instance, that when we were still an integral component of the natural world, operating at an energy level of a few hundred watts, and had not yet discovered agriculture, our global population was only around 10 million people. It has now grown to be effectively 20,000 times larger over such a short period of time that it has led to a major disruption of the dynamical evolutionary balance of nature, and therefore to potentially catastrophic ecological and environmental consequences. This is all pretty sobering, but it's even more so when one is reminded of the inevitable inefficiencies in our use of energy and the subsequent production of entropy resulting in pollution, low-grade heat, and environmental damage and destruction. Of the annual world energy consumption, which is up by a factor of almost 2 from its value in 1980, roughly 1/3 goes to waste. For example, only about 20% of the energy in gasoline is actually used to keep a car moving. A major role of innovation is to decrease such inefficiencies by refining extant technologies, inventing new ones, or developing new ways of organizing their uses. We are witnessing increasing public and corporate consciousness of the challenges of energy consumption, waste, and inefficiency, as government programs and taxation policies encourage new ways of thinking and addressing these issues. There is no doubt that significant progress has been and will continue to be made. But can it be enough? It is a matter of faith that the free market system geared to open-ended growth, even when tempered by governmental intervention, stimulation, and regulation, can find a meta-stable balance between making significant profits and solving the problem of sustainability. The primary function of business, after all, is not to increase efficiencies, but to make profits. Life on our planet evolved and has been sustained by transforming energy directly from the sun into biological metabolic energy that fuels organisms. This amazing process has continued successfully for more than 2 billion years, and as such can confidently be referred to as being sustainable, despite continuous changes in the dramatis personae representing new, innovative life forms resulting from natural selection. A crucial element in how life has been sustained is that the energy source, namely the sun, was external, reliable, and relatively constant. It shone every day, and any variation in its output occurred over long enough periods of time for adaptations to accommodate to the change. This ongoing, ever-evolving, quasi-steady state very slowly began to change with our discovery of fire, which is the chemical process that releases the sun's energy stored in dead wood. When coupled with the invention of agriculture, this began the transition to the Anthropocene as we emerged from a purely biological organism to our present state as an urbanized socio-economic creature no longer in meta-equilibrium with the natural world. The truly dramatic and revolutionary departure from almost 3 billion years of sustainable business as usual came about in just the last 200 years, when our discovery and exploitation of the sun's energy stored underground in coal and oil heralded the beginning of the urbanocene. Fossil fuels were, and still are, perceived like the sun itself as an almost limitless source of energy, whose subsequent release sparked the Industrial Revolution. From a scientific perspective, the truly revolutionary character of the Industrial Revolution was the dramatic change from an open system, where energy is supplied externally by the sun, to a closed system, where energy is supplied internally by fossil fuel. This is a fundamental systemic change with huge thermodynamic consequences, because in a closed system, the second law of thermodynamics and its requirement that entropy always increases strictly applies. We progressed from an external, reliable and constant source of energy to one that is internal, unreliable and variable. Furthermore, because our dominant source of energy is now an integral component of the very system it is supporting, its supply is hostage to continually changing internal market forces. Powered by fossil fuels, our socio-economic accomplishments in just 200 years surpass anything that natural selection, powered directly by the sun, has ever done biologically over such a short period of time. But there is a potentially heavy price to pay for letting the fossil energy genie out of the bottle, and we have to either learn to live with it, if possible, or put it back in the bottle whence it came. An example of the consequences of the second law is the warming of the atmosphere due to the release of energy stored underground in fossil fuels onto the surface of the planet. This is strongly enhanced by the production of gases such as carbon dioxide and methane as entropic byproducts from burning these fuels, leading to the well-known greenhouse effect in which heat gets trapped in the atmosphere. I will not be discussing in any detail how the rates of physical and chemical processes depend on temperature, other than to reiterate that they scale exponentially rather than as a power law. Consequently, the processes that govern the weather and the life history of plants and animals are exponentially sensitive to small changes in the temperature at which they operate. I remind you that a 2 degrees centigrade rise in average temperature leads to a whopping 20% increase in these rates. So small changes in the ambient temperature over relatively short periods of time that are not sufficiently long for adaptive processes to develop can lead to huge ecological and climatological effects. Some of these may be positive, but many will be catastrophic. Regardless, however, of the sign of the effect, significant changes are upon us, and we desperately need to understand their origins and consequences, and forge strategies for adaptation and mitigation. The crucial question is not whether these effects are anthropogenic in origin, because they almost certainly are, but rather to what extent they can be minimized without leading to rapid, discontinuous changes in our physical and economic environment, and ultimately to the potential collapse of the global socio-economic fabric. Hence my bewilderment at those in the general public, including political and corporate leaders, who reject the cautionary exhortations of scientists, environmentalists, and others, and why I am continually baffled by their lack of action. Yes, we should all delight in and promote the huge successes and fruits of the free market system, and of the role of human ingenuity and innovation. But we should also recognize the critical roles of energy and entropy, and together act strategically to find global solutions to their deleterious consequences. Despite the obviously central role that energy has played in bringing us to this point in the history of the planet, and in particular in the socio-economic development of modern human societies, you will be hard-pressed to find even a sentence or two about it in any classic textbook on economics. Remarkably, concepts like energy and entropy, metabolism and carrying capacity have not found their way into mainstream economics. The continued growth of economies, markets and populations over the past 200 years, coupled with a parallel increase in standards of living, are, not surprisingly, seen as testament to the success of classic economic thinking and as a rejection of neo-Malthusian ideas. There has been no need to think seriously in terms of energy as an underlying driver of economic success or of population growth, let alone to consider entropy as its inevitable consequence. Nor has there been the need to consider the possibility that resources may actually be limited, nor that there might be underlying physical constraints that would question open-ended growth, until now. These issues have been conceptually circumvented by invoking the almost magical role that innovation and human ingenuity have played, and presumably will continue to play, in keeping the entire enterprise viable, especially if stimulated by a relatively free market economy. Just as the concept of a mysterious, almost limitless dark energy is invoked to explain why the physical universe continues to expand exponentially, so the specter of an almost limitless supply of innovative ideas is invoked to explain why the socio-economic universe will continue to expand, overcoming all obstacles in its course. In addition, there also seems to be an unexpressed presumption that ideas, the seeds of innovation, cost nothing. After all, they are just neural processes in the brains of human beings, and collectively we can produce an almost infinite number of them in our heads. But like everything else, ideas and the innovations they inspire require energy. Lots of it, to support the smart individuals who are thinking, and to provide the appropriately stimulating environments and collective experiences we institutionalize in places such as universities, laboratories, parliaments, cafes, concert halls, and conference venues. The very essence of this is embodied in the concept of the city and of urban life. This was aptly expressed by the famous anthropologist Margaret Mead, who observed, "The city as a center, where, any day in any year, there may be a fresh encounter with a new talent, a keen mind, or a gifted specialist. This is essential to the life of a country. Indeed, cities have evolved as the engine we invented for enhancing and facilitating social interaction, thereby stimulating idea creation and innovation. Smart and ambitious people are drawn to cities, and this is where our new ideas are incubated, where entrepreneurship flourishes, and where wealth is created. Supporting all of this is extremely expensive. So it is naive to dissociate ideas from energy. One cannot flourish without the other. Of the trillions of thoughts, ideas, speculations, and proposals for new machines, new products, and new theories, only an infinitesimal minority ever lead to any significance. Almost all fall by the wayside, even though as a totality they all contribute a necessary background noise and Weltanschauung for new and innovative phenomena to arise and blossom. All of this requires huge amounts of energy. Ex nihilo nihil fit. Nothing comes from nothing. A possible science of sustainability requires understanding global dynamics as a complex, evolving, adaptive system composed of many interlocking and interacting subsystems that are themselves complex adaptive systems, all evolving together, potentially under energy, resource, and informational constraints. We need to understand how the dynamics of innovation, technological advances, urbanization, financial markets, social networks, and population dynamics are interconnected, and how their evolving interrelationships fuel growth and societal change, and as manifestations of human endeavors, how they are all integrated into a holistic, interacting, systemic framework, and whether such a dynamically evolving system is ultimately sustainable. The arguments of those like Malthus, Paul Ehrlich, and the Club of Rome may be flawed, but their conclusions and implications may well have validity. In any case, they did us a great service by raising some of the most important existential issues humankind has to face as we move almost blindly into the 21st century. Although the population bomb has been swept under the rug, questions of sustainable energy supply and its potential deleterious consequences have been brought to consciousness and are now being seriously debated. Viewed from the standpoint of the enormous flux of energy that is reliably delivered on time every day by the sun to the earth, there is no energy problem. To get a sense of the relative scales involved, consider the following. The total amount of energy delivered by the sun to the earth is approximately 1,000,000,000,000,000, 10 to the 18th, kilowatt hours a year, compared with our measly needs, on this scale, of 150 trillion, 1.5 times 10 to the 14th, kilowatt hours we collectively use each year. So, on the scale of what the Earth receives from the Sun, our energy use represents only about 0.015% of what is, in principle, actually available to us. To put it another way, more energy is delivered by the Sun in just 1 hour than is used by the entire world in a single year. Indeed, the scale of solar energy is so vast that in 1 year it is about twice as much as will ever be obtained from all of the Earth's non-renewable resources of coal, oil, natural gas, and uranium combined. So from this point of view, there is no energy problem, at least in principle. Consequently, the long-term strategy for sustained global energy availability is clear. We need to return to the biological paradigm where most of our energy needs are supplied directly from the sun, but in such a way as to maintain and expand what we have so far accomplished. We urgently need to develop the technology that will enable us to harness affordable, abundant energy from the sun, primarily from direct radiation, but also indirectly from wind, tidal forces, and wave motion. What a marvelous challenge to our professed ingenuity and powers of innovation. Here's the opportunity for dynamic and charismatic political and corporate leadership to forge the way to a sustainable global energy future based on the dynamics of entrepreneurship, the free market system, and government stimulation. Surely, with a track record of remarkable inventions that include the steam turbine, the telephone, the laptop computer, the internet, quantum mechanics, and the theory of relativity, this should be a piece of cake. However, one of the more mysterious aspects of the 21st century is that those who seem most vocal in promoting and celebrating innovation and the free market economy as the engine of sustainability seem so reluctant to recognize the urgency of the challenge, and to champion research and development in exploiting the almost infinite power of solar energy. The lack of progress until relatively recently is quite astonishing, given that the basic technology for developing solar energy has been known for more than 100 years. In 1897, an American engineer, Frank Schumann, built a proof-of-principle device for utilizing energy from the sun by showing that it could power a small steam engine. His system was eventually patented in 1912, and in 1913 he constructed the world's first solar thermal energy power plant, which was built in Egypt. It generated only about 50 kilowatts, about 65 horsepower, but was able to pump more than 5,000 gallons of water a minute, about 22,000 liters a minute, from the Nile onto adjacent cotton fields. Schumann was an enthusiast and advocate for solar energy, and in 1916 was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "We have proved the commercial profit of sun power, and have more particularly proved that after our stores of oil and coal are exhausted, the human race can receive unlimited power from the rays of the sun." Given how long ago this statement was made, Schumann's observation was remarkably prescient, even if it is yet to be realized. The discovery and development of cheap oil in the 1930s discouraged the advancement of solar energy, and Schumann's vision and basic design were effectively forgotten until the first energy crises of the 1970s. It is, however, encouraging that technologies such as photovoltaic cells have now been developed that make Schumann's dream a possible reality as the price of renewables begins to become competitive with traditional fossil fuel energy generation. Another fundamental difference between fossil fuel and solar energy lies in the underlying physical mechanism for how their energy is generated. The process of burning fossil fuels releases energy stored in chemical bonds that hold the atoms and molecules of coal, oil, or gas together. All molecules, whether they are the building blocks of your body, your brain, your house, or your computer, are held together by the forces of electromagnetism, and as such are characterized by energies whose magnitude is in the range of electron volts, EV, which is the unit conventionally used to measure them. An electron volt is infinitesimal on the scale of the energies we have been considering. One EV is equivalent to only about a 300 trillion trillionth of a kilowatt hour. One EV equals 3 times 10 to the minus 26th kilowatt hour. So, in terms of these atomic units, the amount of energy we consume each year is about 5 times 10 to the 39th EV. You can loosely think of this as saying that each year we break down this many molecules to supply us with our energy needs. On the other hand, the Sun, which consists primarily of hydrogen and helium, is fueled by nuclear energy stored in the bonds that hold nuclei together. It is released as radiation when hydrogen nuclei fuse together to form helium nuclei. This is called nuclear fusion, and is the fundamental physical mechanism for how the Sun shines, providing us energy in the form of the light and heat that gave rise to all life on the planet. It remains the sole source of energy for all life on Earth, except for us over the past few thousand years, since we discovered its power stored in fossil fuels. The scale of nuclear energy is about a million times larger than that of chemical electromagnetic energy that is released in the burning of fossil fuels. Nuclear processes involve energies in the range of millions of electron volts, MeV, rather than electron volts, characteristic of molecular chemical reactions. It is this huge enhancement factor that makes the idea of exploiting nuclear energy so attractive. The same amount of matter can produce approximately a million times more energy from the nuclei of its atoms than from its molecules. Thus, instead of having to use 500 gallons, about 2,000 liters, of gasoline a year to run your car, you would need only the equivalent of a few grams of nuclear material, about the size of a small pill. The promise of unlimited energy from nuclear power stations producing energy using the same physics that powers the sun is a fantastic idea. When it was first conceived, right after the Second World War, in the heady days following the development of the atomic bomb, there was tremendous optimism that nuclear energy would soon displace fossil fuels as our primary source of energy. I certainly recall as a young teenager in the 1950s reading articles in newspapers proclaiming that by the time I was grown up and a family man, electricity would be so cheap there would be no need to meter it. Typical of this euphoria were proclamations such as that by the Nobel Prize-winning nuclear chemist Glenn Seaborg, who was chair of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, that there will be nuclear-powered Earth-to-Moon shuttles, nuclear-powered artificial hearts, plutonium-heated swimming pools for scuba divers, and much more. Unfortunately, using nuclear fusion to generate economically competitive energy has proven to be quite elusive and technologically extremely challenging, despite vigorous international efforts to make it viable. Instead, nuclear power has been successfully developed using nuclear fission, in which energy is released when heavy nuclei of uranium dissociate into lighter products, a process analogous to conventional chemical production of energy from fossil fuels. At present, about 10% of the world's electricity is generated using fission, with France leading the way with over 80% of its electricity coming from nuclear reactors. Like conventional fossil fuel power plants, energy produced by nuclear reactors is internal to the entire global system, and consequently suffers from similar issues regarding the production of entropy and deleterious byproducts. Although nuclear power, like solar, is not a significant source of greenhouse gases, and therefore not a driver of possible climate change, its byproducts can be extremely deleterious because their energy scale is so much higher, by a factor of a million. Consequently, radiation resulting from nuclear processes can be extremely damaging to molecules, and therefore to organic tissue, leading to serious health issues, of which cancer is the best known. To a large extent, our atmosphere protects us from similar radiation from the sun, but in reactors on Earth, this is a major challenge. In addition, there is the issue of safe and reliable storage and disposal of the waste products from nuclear reactions, which remain radioactive for thousands of years. Despite huge efforts to ensure the safety of nuclear reactors, there have now been enough accidents to have dampened the enthusiasm for their utilization as an alternative energy source to fossil fuels, even though the number of direct fatalities has been extremely small. The reverberations from the disaster at the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan in 2011 have led to a dramatic decrease in the present and projected future reliance on nuclear energy worldwide. Although fossil fuels have caused hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of deaths and an enormous number of health problems, they are still perceived by many as being more desirable than the potential risks coming from nuclear reactors. Questions of long-term safety and quantitative assessments of the entropic consequences of energy production and utilization are a highly complex and controversial social, political, psychological, and scientific issue. How many deaths are caused directly by energy production? How many indirectly? What health issues are considered dangerous? And what are their long-term consequences? How do we compare different technologies? What metrics should we be using? Just to give a sense of the sorts of comparisons we have to make, consider the following. We are surprisingly tolerant of death and destruction arising from unnatural man-made causes when they occur on a continual and regular basis, but are extremely intolerant when they occur suddenly as discrete events, even though the numbers involved are much smaller. For instance, each year more than 1.25 million people die from car accidents worldwide, which is comparable to the number who die from lung cancer, the most common cause of cancer death. Nevertheless, the fear and anxiety about dying from cancer seems to be far greater than the concern about being killed in an automobile accident, and this is reflected in the large discrepancy in the resources we devote to addressing each of these problems. It is interesting to compare both of these to the number of people who have died directly from nuclear accidents. Even when integrated over the entire lifetime of all nuclear power plants, this is less than 100 people. And most of them died in the Chernobyl disaster in the USSR in 1986, while none died at Fukushima. On the other hand, many thousands may have contracted cancer and died, or will die prematurely, because of radiation exposure from such accidents, particularly from Chernobyl. But this should be balanced by the estimated 50 million people who are injured, maimed, or disabled each year by car accidents. And so the arguments go back and forth as we try to compare apples and oranges, grappling for the appropriate metrics to help us make these difficult decisions and comparisons as we try to prioritize the global energy portfolio that will play a central role in determining how society evolves in the coming decades. Adding to our difficulties are the psychosocial imponderables, such as the almost universal love affair with the automobile and the almost universal fear of a major nuclear power disaster, which is difficult to disentangle from the universal fear of nuclear bombs. My intention here is not to give a complete review of the pros and cons of energy options, but rather to present a few simple examples of the sorts of quantitative statistics that we need to ponder in debating these issues. We need to think quantitatively, and to develop the underlying science that is needed for addressing these challenges so as to inform rational political decisions. Regardless of whether one believes in the innovative capacity of human beings to solve the problems of nuclear energy, whether fusion or fission, or the challenge of affordable and reliable solar technology sufficient to support the energy needs of 10 billion people, or to reverse the amount of carbon we are pumping into our atmosphere, we are still left with the long-term problem of entropy production. apart from its many other issues, the nuclear option, like that of traditional fossil fuels, keeps us trapped in the paradigm of a closed system, whereas the solar option has the critical capacity for potentially returning us to a truly sustainable paradigm of an open system. Chapter 6. Prelude to a Science of Cities. 1. Are cities and companies just very large organisms? The success of the network-based theory for understanding scaling laws and providing a big-picture conceptual framework for quantitatively addressing diverse questions across a broad spectrum of biology naturally leads to the question of whether this framework could be extended to understand other networked systems, such as cities and companies. Superficially, these have much in common with organisms and ecosystems. After all, they metabolize energy and resources, produce waste, process information, grow, adapt and evolve, contract disease, and even develop what could be characterized as tumors and growths. In addition, they age, and in the case of companies, almost all of them eventually die. Whereas, for cities, only extremely few ever do, an enigma we shall come to consider later. Many of us blithely use phrases like the metabolism of a city, the ecology of the marketplace, the DNA of a company, and so on, as if cities and companies were biological. Even as far back as Aristotle, we find him continually referring to the city, the polis, as a natural, organic, autonomous entity. In more recent times, an influential movement in architecture has arisen called metabolism, which was explicitly inspired by analogy with the idea of biological regeneration driven by metabolic processes. This views architecture as an integral component of urban planning and development, and as a continually evolving process, implying that buildings should be designed ab initio with change in mind. One of its original proponents was the well-known Japanese architect Kenzo Tanga, the 1987 winner of the Pritzker Prize, considered to be the Nobel Prize of Architecture. I find his designs, however, to be surprisingly inorganic, dominated by right angles and concrete and somewhat soulless, rather than having the curvaceous, softer qualities of an organism. Writers, too, have expressed organic visions of cities. An extreme example is Jack Kerouac, one of the charismatic founders of beat poetry and literature in the 1950s, who whimsically wrote, "Paris is a woman, but London is an independent man puffing his pipe in a pub." However, it is in business that the concepts and language, if not the actual science of ecology and evolutionary biology, have seized the imagination, especially in Silicon Valley. The concept of a business ecosystem has become a standard buzzword to connote a sort of Darwinian survival of the fittest in the marketplace. This was introduced in 1993 by James Moore, then at Harvard Law School, in an article he wrote titled "Predators and Prey, A New Ecology of Competition," which won the McKinsey Award for Article of the Year. It's a fairly standard ecological narrative, with individual businesses replacing animals in the evolutionary dynamics of natural selection. In keeping with much of the traditional literature on understanding companies, it's entirely qualitative with no quantitative predictive power. Its great virtue is that it emphasizes the role of community structure, the importance of systemic thinking, and the inevitable processes of innovation, adaptation, and evolution. So are all of these references to biological concepts and processes just qualitative metaphors in the same way we loosely use scientific jargon like quantum leap or momentum to describe phenomena that are difficult to capture in conventional language? Or do they express something deeper and more substantive, connoting that cities and companies are indeed just very large organisms following the rules of biology and natural selection. These were the kinds of general ruminations I was contemplating when I began informal discussions in 2001 to 2002 with colleagues at the Santa Fe Institute, whose backgrounds were in the socio-economic sciences. Fortuitously, Sander van der Leeuw, a well-known anthropologist, then at the University of Paris, who later moved to run the School of Sustainability at Arizona State University, was on sabbatical leave at SFI, and David Lane, who had previously run the SFI economics program, was often on site. David was a well-known statistician, who, inspired by SFI, had switched to economics. He had been the chair of statistics at the University of Minnesota, but had moved to the University of Modena in Italy, where he began a program oriented toward understanding innovation, especially in the manufacturing sector that had been the lifeblood of northern Italy. You probably recognize Modena for its marvelous balsamic vinegar, not to mention as the home of Ferrari, Lamborghini, and Maserati. On my first visit there, David introduced me to their traditional balsamic vinegar, a remarkable elixir, to be distinguished from the tamer stuff many of us nowadays use on our salads, but which costs a good deal more than some of the most expensive bottles of wine I've ever bought. Despite my skepticism, David and Sander convinced me that extending the network-based scaling theory from biology to social organizations was indeed a worthwhile project. They became the prime movers in putting together a broad program that covered our joint interests ranging from innovation and information transfer in both ancient and modern societies to understanding the structure and dynamics of cities and companies, all from a complexity perspective. The program was called the Information Society as a Complex System, ISCOM, and was generously funded by the European Union. Shortly thereafter, Denise Poumin, a well-known urban geographer at the Sorbonne in Paris, joined our collaboration, and the four of us each ran one component of the project. I assembled a new multidisciplinary collaboration centered on SFI, whose first goal was to ask whether cities and companies manifest scaling, and if so, to develop a quantitative principled theory for understanding their structure and dynamics. As in much of life, it is often instructive to take a retrospective look at what one had proposed to do long after it's over. For instance, if I look back at the list of attendees at one of our early workshops, very few of them eventually became ongoing members of the collaboration. This is not unusual at the beginning of a program such as this that proposes to broach new questions that transcend disciplinary boundaries. At the outset, all kinds of people with diverse backgrounds, who are well-versed in expertise that might be pertinent to the program, are invited to participate in the hope that synergies will happen, sparks will fly, and a real sense of purpose and excitement about prospects for something new will be generated. Many find, however, that even if they are fascinated by the intellectual challenges and potential outcomes of the proposed project, it simply isn't compelling enough to sacrifice the time to get fully involved and reset the priorities of their own research agendas. Others discover that they really aren't that interested after all, or that it's unlikely that anything of substance will come out of the effort. Eventually, however, by word of mouth, by serendipitous connections and informal discussions, and by osmosis and diffusion, an evolving group of researchers emerges whose members are, to varying degrees, willing to commit to a longer-term involvement with the challenge, and who will actually do the substantive work over the ensuing years. Such was the process that led to the scaling and social organization component of ISCOM. Although its scope and emphasis broadened as progress was made, the vision of the proposal remained pretty much intact over the years. Its motivation was originally expressed as follows. because of the obvious analogy with social network systems, such as corporate and urban structures, it is both natural and compelling to investigate the possibility of extending the same sort of analyses used for understanding biological network systems to social organizations, with an added emphasis that the flow of information in social organizations is as significant as the flow of matter, energy, and resources. Many questions were asked, including, what is a social organization? What are the appropriate scaling laws? What constraints must be satisfied by the architecture of the structures that channel social flows of information, matter, and energy? In particular, are the relevant constraints all physical? Or might there also be social and cognitive constraints that must be taken into account? New York, Los Angeles, and Dallas superficially look and feel quite different from one another, as do Tokyo, Osaka, and Kyoto, or Paris, Lyon, and Marseille. Yet their differences are relatively small compared with the differences we perceive between whales, horses, and monkey, which, as was shown earlier, are actually scaled versions of one another following simple power law scaling relationships. These hidden regularities are manifestations of the physics and mathematics of the underlying networks that transport energy and resources in their bodies. Cities are sustained by similar network systems such as roads, railways, and electrical lines that transport people, energy, and resources, and whose flow is therefore a manifestation of the metabolism of the city. These flows are the physical lifeblood of all cities, and as with organisms, their structure and dynamics have tended to evolve by the continuous feedback mechanisms inherent in a selective process toward an approximate optimization by minimizing costs and time. Regardless of the city, most people on average want to get from A to B in the shortest possible time at the cheapest cost, and most businesses want to do likewise with their supply and delivery systems. This suggests that, despite appearances, cities might also be approximate, scaled versions of one another in much the same way that mammals are. Cities, however, are much more than just the physicality of their buildings and structures connected and serviced by various transport systems. Although we tend to think of cities in physical terms, the beautiful boulevards of Paris, the London Underground, the skyscrapers of New York, the temples of Kyoto, and so on, cities are much more than their physical infrastructure. In fact, the real essence of a city is its people. They provide its buzz, its soul, and its spirit, those indefinable characteristics we viscerally feel when we are participating in the life of a successful city. This may seem obvious, but the emphasis of those who think about cities, such as planners, architects, economists, politicians, and policymakers, is primarily focused on their physicality, rather than on the people who inhabit them and how they interact with one another. It is all too often forgotten that the whole point of a city is to bring people together, to facilitate interaction, and thereby to create ideas and wealth, to enhance innovative thinking and encourage entrepreneurship and cultural activity by taking advantage of the extraordinary opportunities that the diversity of a city offers. This is the magic formula that we discovered 10,000 years ago when we inadvertently began the process of urbanization. Its unintended consequences have resulted in an exponentially increasing population, whose quality of life and standard of living have, on the average, also been increasing. Like almost everything else involving the psychosocial world of human beings, William Shakespeare understood our fundamental symbiotic relationship with cities. In his rather gruesome political drama Coriolanus, a Roman tribune named Sicinius rhetorically remarks, "What is the city but the people?" To which the citizens, the plebs, emphatically respond, "True, the people are the city." Which I translate to mean, cities are emergent, complex, adaptive social network systems resulting from the continuous interactions among their inhabitants, enhanced and facilitated by the feedback mechanisms provided by urban life. 2. St. Jane and the Dragons. No one is more identified with viewing cities through the collective lives of their citizens than the famous urban writer-theorist Jane Jacobs. Her defining book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, had an enormous influence across the globe on how we think about cities and how we approach urban planning. It's required reading for anyone interested in cities, whether a student, a professional, or just an intellectually curious citizen. I suspect that every mayor of every major city in the world has a copy of Jane's book sitting somewhere on his or her bookshelf, and has read at least parts of it. It's a wonderful book. Extremely provocative and insightful, highly polemical and personal, very entertaining and well-written. Although published in 1961 and explicitly focused on major American cities of that period, its message is very much broader. In some ways, it is perhaps more widely relevant now than it was then, especially outside of the United States, as many cities have followed variations of the classic American urban trajectory with the dominance and challenge of the automobile, the mall, the growth of suburbia, and the consequent loss of community. Ironically, Jane had no fancy academic credentials, not even an undergraduate degree, nor did she engage in traditional research activities. Her writings are more like journalistic narratives based primarily on anecdotes, personal experience, and a deep, intuitive understanding of what cities are, how they work, and how they should work. Despite the explicit focus on great American cities in her book, one gets the impression that most of her analyses and commentaries are based on her personal experiences of New York City. She was extraordinarily intolerant of urban planners and politicians, and vicious in her attacks on traditional urban planning, especially in regard to its apparent lack of recognition that people, not buildings and highways, were primary. These classic quotes from her writing are typical of her critical attitude. The pseudoscience of planning seems almost neurotic in its determination to imitate empiric failure and ignore empiric success. In this dependence on maps as some sort of higher reality, project planners and urban designers assume they can create a promenade simply by mapping one in where they want it, then having it built. But a promenade needs promenaders. There is no logic that can be superimposed on the city. People make it, and it is to them, not buildings, that we must fit our plans. We can see what people like. His aim was the creation of self-sufficient small towns, really very nice towns if you were docile and had no plans of your own and did not mind spending your life with others with no plans of their own. As in all utopias, the right to have plans of any significance belonged only to the planner in charge. The his, in this last quote, is a reference to Sir Ebenezer Howard, the inventor of the concept of the Garden City. This has had a powerful influence on town planning throughout the 20th century, providing the idealized model of suburbs around the world. Howard was a visionary utopian thinker who was strongly affected by the plight and exploitation of the working class in 19th century Britain. Howard's vision of the Garden City was a planned community with distinct areas of residences, housing, factories, industry, and nature, agriculture, in prescribed proportions that he deemed ideal for providing the best of urban and country living. No slums, no pollution, plenty of fresh air with room to breathe, and to live the good life. The integration of town and country was seen as a step toward a new civilized society, a curious marriage between libertarianism and socialism. His garden cities would be largely independent, but managed cooperatively by the citizens who had an economic interest in them, though they would not own the land. Unlike most utopian dreams, Howard's vision struck a resonant chord among both liberal thinkers and hardcore investors. He was able to form a company that raised sufficient private investment to build two garden cities from scratch north of London. Letchworth Garden City, 1899, whose present population is 33,000, and Welwyn Garden City, 1919, now with 43,000 inhabitants. However, in order to accomplish this dream in the real world, many of his ideals had to be sacrificed or seriously compromised, including his rigid, top-down design plans that Jane Jacobs railed against. Nevertheless, his basic philosophy of a planned town and country community has persisted to this day, and has left its mark not only on the many variants of garden cities that have since sprung up around the world, but also in the design concept of almost every suburban development of every city. An interesting special case of this on a large scale is Singapore. Even as the city has grown to become a major global financial center with more than 5 million inhabitants, and has continued to build the usual ostentatious steel and glass skyscrapers, its saving grace is that it has maintained the dream of being a garden city on a grand scale. This is primarily due to its visionary top-down leader, the late Lee Kuan Yew, who had the foresight in 1967 to require that Singapore develop as a city in a garden, with abundant vegetation, open green spaces, and a sense of tropical lushness, despite its chronic shortage of land. Singapore may not be the world's most exciting city, but its ambience of greenness is palpable. Ironically, Howard's actual design of these garden cities was not at all organic. Their layout and organization are the very essence of simple Euclidean geometry, with the only curves in sight being perfect circles connected by perfect straight lines, the very opposite of the apparently jumbled mess of organically evolved cities, towns, and villages. No fractal-like boundaries, surfaces, or networks a la Mandelbrot appear in Ebenezer Howard's vision of a garden city. This move away from organic geometry